Good morning, everyone. Well, this morning I would like to begin with a few reflections following on yesterday's last session and the discussion, the questions, some of the questions that arose during the at the end of the second session yesterday afternoon. The first thing that I want to say is that my purpose here is not to convert anyone to the Mahayana. My assignment here is to teach the basic doctrines of the Mahayana, and that's what I'm trying to do to the best of my ability. As a matter of fact, if there are people out there who are sincerely training within the Theravada tradition, who are earnestly striving to become arhats, the last thing I want to do is to discourage them or change their minds or confuse them or drag them willy-nilly into the Mahayana path. That's the last thing that I want to do. Actually, I would be very happy to see more arhats around, whether or not they sometime in the far future become Buddhas or not, whether they remain dwelling in Nirvana or not. A Tibetan historian who wrote a history of Buddhism in India, commenting upon the fact that they had a difficult time convening sufficient arhats to take part in the Fourth Council, asked the question, why were there so few arhats at the time of the Fourth Council? This is at the end of the first century CE, as you might remember. And he answers the question in the following way. He says that today, this is, now it is 2,000 years ago, nearly 2,000 years ago. He says today there aren't, in this period there were no longer so many arhats as there were during the time of the Buddha, because today people spend too much time debating with each other, and they don't spend enough time in meditation, they don't spend enough time in secluded contemplation. So to achieve arhatship is a highly commendable goal. I always remember something that was said of Achan Mun, who was one of the masters of the Thai forest meditation tradition, and who many people believe was an arhat. And he's reported to have said at one point in his practice that he made a decision to strive for arhatship single-mindedly, because so long as he had the inclination, the temptation, if you like, to follow the bodhisattva path, this was delaying his progress toward nirvana or toward arhatship. So at the end of the day, which path you follow, the Theravada path, which goal you aspire for, the goal of arhatship, or whether you follow the Mahayana path and aspire for Buddhahood and so on, this is a personal choice. This is a choice that everybody has to make according to their own judgment of which path, which practice is congenial to them, which goal is attractive to them, which goal they are convinced is suitable for them. So this is a personal decision. My purpose here is just to tell you about the Mahayana doctrines and what the Mahayana discourses, what the Mahayana sutras say. Naturally, the Mahayana sutras, part of their agenda, part of their purpose, is to depreciate the value of arhatship. The Mahayana sutras are extolling, they are exalting the value of the bodhisattva path, the excellence of aspiring to become a Buddha, the aspiration to become a Buddha. Their purpose is, in that sense, they are propagandizing. In that sense, they are putting forward an agenda. They're putting forward a program. And part of that program, of course, is to devalue or to depreciate the attainment of the arhats. This happens not only in the Lotus Sutra, it happens in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, it happens in many Mahayana sutras. And this is not surprising because the Mahayana sutras are there for a purpose. They're there for the purpose of extolling and praising and declaring the superiority of the goal of Buddhahood and the superiority of the Bodhisattva path. So it's not surprising that we will find in the Mahayana sutras some criticism of the arhats, some references, some extensive descriptions of the arhat goal as being limited, as being inferior, as being provisional, etc. So this is not surprising. Some time ago, we talked about the question came up about Theravada refutations of the Mahayana, and I said that to my knowledge there were none that I knew of. And I think that is for, when I thought about this afterwards, it seems to me that one reason for that is that the easiest way, the best way to refute the Mahayana from the Theravada point of view is just to ignore it, just to refuse to recognize the authenticity of the Mahayana scriptures. If you refuse to recognize that the Mahayana scriptures are authentic, then you have no need to engage in a debate with the Mahayana. If you begin to engage in a philosophical debate with the Mahayana, then you are going to find yourself in some difficulty, because there are a lot of, as I pointed out, there are a lot of Mahayana elements in the Theravada Pali Canon, and it is going to be very difficult to refute the Mahayana simply on the basis of commonly accepted scriptures. I'll give you some examples. Let's think for a moment about nirvana, about the definition of nirvana, because a lot of the debate, a lot of the disagreements that occur between Mahayana and Theravada, as is very often the case, a lot of the disagreements come down to a matter of terminology. And to a matter of definition. So what is the definition of nirvana? We know the Buddha defined nirvana in different ways according to the Pali texts. The Buddha said that nirvana was unconditioned, that it was beyond birth and death, that it was beyond earth, water, fire, air, and so forth. But the Buddha also defined nirvana as the highest bliss, the supreme happiness, paramam sukham. So the Buddha defined nirvana in various ways, not only in negative terms, but also in positive terms. And in addition to all of the texts that we looked at yesterday, excerpts from the Pali Suttas, where the Buddha specifically says that nirvana or the Tathagata after death is not non-existent. In addition to that, the whole conception of extinction, you know, because another, in fact, in the formula of the Four Noble Truths, for example, the third noble truth is not stated in terms of nirvana. The third noble truth is called cessation or nirodha. Some people translate it extinction. But what does extinction mean? How is extinction different from annihilation? Why does Yamaka, for example, hold the view that the Tathagata is annihilated, that the monk whose mind is free from outflows, free from asavas, how is it that Yamaka's view that this monk after death is totally annihilated, how is it that that view is expressly criticized, that it's called an evil view? What is meant by nirodha? What is meant by cessation? Is it meant in a simplistic, nihilistic way? I don't think so. I think what nirodha means is the cessation of defilements, the cessation of karma. That doesn't mean the cessation of some form of being. Let's look also at the second of the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truth of the cause of suffering. How is that defined? How is that explained? The second of the Four Noble Truths, I'm sure all of you know, is the truth of craving. There are three kinds of craving that form the definition of the second noble truth, which is craving. What are the three kinds of craving? Yes, could you speak up a little bit, please? Right. So the third one is a craving for non-existence. No? Now, it would be very odd if one of the forms of craving was the craving for non-existence and nirvana was non-existence. You know, so what I'm saying here is that nirvana is a state which is by nature undefinable. No? You can't really define it. You can only point at it. You can only make certain indirect or suggestive descriptions of it, certain metaphors. It's an experience, like all experiences, it's essentially undefinable if we don't share that experience. Now this may sound, excuse me if this is, you know, too superficial or too facetious, but I always, in Southeast Asia, when I first came to Southeast Asia, I was giving a talk about the Third Noble Truth and so forth, and talking about the inexpressibility of nirvana because it's an experience and so forth. And I said, supposing I've just come to Southeast Asia and I've never tasted durian, how would you explain to me what a durian tastes like? How could I come to understand? And this is something, this is a simple and a facetious, not a very serious example, but today, as we sit in this classroom here in Songkhla, there is a branch of modern philosophy, contemporary philosophy, called consciousness studies. And one of the principal thought experiments of this field of consciousness studies is the study called the Red Room, or the study of the Red Room. And the idea of this thought experiment is, supposing you put someone in a room who had never seen the color red, supposing you put them in a room which had no red objects, but which had all the possible information about the color red, the wavelength of the color, thousands of examples of things that are red, apples, cherries, and so forth. No pictures, just words. Apples are red, cherries are red. Every possible kind of information about red without the presence of an actual red thing, something that is actually red. Would that person ever, no matter how long he worked at it, no matter how seriously he studied everything about red, would he know what red was? The answer is he wouldn't. He would have to experience red in order to know what red is. So similarly, the essential character of nirvana is that it's indescribable. So it is beyond existence and non-existence and both existence and non-existence. And it also can't be, I don't think that it can be properly described or called extinction, in the sense that if you call nirvana extinction, you have to qualify that extinction. Extinction of the klesha, extinction of karma. You cannot just call it extinction, because if you call it extinction, it is too similar to annihilation, to death, to non-existence. The normal, the common meaning of extinction in English is dead, and dead for a long time, like the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs are extinct. So I don't think that we can call nirvana extinction. Actually, the first translation of the Lotus Sutra, the one that I didn't want to use for this course, was done by a man named Kearns. And every time the term nirvana occurs in the text, do you know how he translates it? He translates it death. Let's forgive him, let's be compassionate. He translated the text 100 years ago. But if you translate nirvana as extinction or as death, to some extent, this is a nihilistic view. All the materialists, all the people who believe that when the body breaks up, nothing exists, nothing follows, they all attain nirvana when they die. They don't have to practice. They don't have to achieve anything. They believe, the materialists, a lot of people today believe, when the body breaks up, that's it. They enter into extinction. There is nothing. So I think we need to be careful not to conceive nirvana nihilistically. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to embrace everything that the Mahayana says and all of the Mahayana declarations about the eventual destiny of the arhats and this and that. You can embrace that, you can believe that, you can reserve judgment. All that we ever ask anyone to do is to reserve judgment. You don't have to believe it, but reserve judgment. Just let it be. Don't necessarily discard it. The fact is that even according to the pre-Mahayana schools, and now I'm referring to Abhidharma sources from the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma and the Sarvastivadin Vinaya. So they're not Pali sources, they're Sanskrit sources, but they are early sources. And they're not fully fledged Mahayana sources. I've already told you a little bit about the Sarvastivadin inclination toward the Bodhisattva path and their fascination with the Jataka stories and so forth. But the Sarvastivada Vinaya also contains a couple of very interesting legends. Let's call them legends, and let's not put too much weight on them. Let's just call them legends. let's not take that step, that further step, and call them fact. But they were legends. They were legends that were believed and preserved in the Sarvastivada text. There's the legend of the Arhat Pindala, Pindala Bharadwaja. Now, I think some of you will know the story of Pindala. Certainly some of our Sangha members will have heard of it. Well, there was a householder during the time of the Buddha who put a golden alms bowl up on a very high pole, 40-foot high pole or 50-foot high pole. He put this golden begging bowl on the top of the pole, and he said that, "I want to see one of you monks or ascetics fetch that bowl down from the top of the pole." In other words, he was demanding a proof of miraculous powers. So a number of ascetics came and tried to fetch the bowl down from the pole, and none of them succeeded. Pindala Bharadwaja came along, flew up to the top of the pole, took the golden alms bowl, and flew around the town 3 times with it. Later, according to another story, he took a piece of a mountain also and flew around the town with this piece of a mountain. Anyway, this was... The Buddha did not approve of these kinds of demonstrations of supernatural powers. And so, according to the legend, the Buddha punished Pindala by saying, "You cannot enter into Nirvana. You have to remain in the world." And the story goes on, the legend goes on to recount the assembly at the time of the Third Council and how everyone was there, Moggallithissa, Thera, and Emperor Ashoka, and everyone was there, everyone was assembled ready to start the Third Council, and the seat of honor was empty. And Ashoka was getting a little bit impatient, and because he thought that Moggallithissa Thera would sit on the seat of honor, but Moggallithissa Thera refused. He was not sitting on the seat of honor. Everyone was waiting. All of a sudden, flying through the sky comes the Arhat Pindala. Now this is 350 years after the time of the Buddha. Arhat Pindala comes, takes his seat as the head of the council. His eyebrows have grown so long, they've grown white, and they've grown so long that they cover his eyes. He has to lift up his eyebrows in order to look out. And then later, the Emperor Ashoka asks Pindala to please take him around to the sites where the great event of the Buddha's life took place. And so the Arhat Pindala acts as a kind of guide for the Emperor Ashoka and takes him to these various sites. Now, however we want to weigh this story, it's a legend, but it's a legend according to which one of the Arhats, Pindala, did not enter Parinirvana, but still continued to be present in the world. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, Pindala is one of the 16 Arhats that you have in the Chinese tradition, that are very important in the Chinese tradition. Arhats who act as guardians of the Dharma, as protectors of the Dharma. Arhats who have not entered into Nirvana. Similarly, in the Sarvastivada and Vinaya, we have a story about Mahakasyapa and how Mahakasyapa is in fact entombed in a mountain, remains in this mountain, and will remain in this mountain until the coming of the future Buddha Maitreya, because at that time Mahakasyapa is supposed to hand his bowl and his robe over to Maitreya, the next Buddha. So the Sarvastivadins also have this idea of even the arhats not necessarily entering nirvana, but continuing to have a presence in the world. So my point is simply this one, that it is a question that was a live one. It was a question that was an open question during the formative years of the Buddhist tradition, even before the advent of the Mahayana. So let's think, let's remember that nirvana is an undefinable state, that it is not existence, not non-existence, not both existence and non-existence, not neither existence nor non-existence, that it is the highest happiness, that it is the greatest good, that it is beyond all of our conceptions. And I think if we keep that in mind, we need to recognize that we cannot simply define nirvana as extinction or as non-existence or as annihilation, because there's too much evidence, even in the Pali Canon, to allow us to do that. Well, these are some of the thoughts that were going through my mind following upon yesterday's question and answer session. For what they're worth, I've shared them with you. I want now to talk a little bit about the two central parables in the Lotus Sutra, the ones that Mrs. Santino will read you excerpts from during the second hour today. And those two parables, similes that I've chosen to focus upon are the parable contained in the 16th chapter entitled The Lifespan of the Tathagata and the parable contained in the third chapter, the parable of the burning house, or the parable of the house on fire. Now, the message of the parable that occurs in the 16th chapter, the parable of the wise physician, the essential message of the chapter, The Lifespan of the Tathagata, is that the lifespan of the Tathagata is immeasurable. And I don't know whether the excerpt that we have selected contains this passage or not, but there is a lengthy passage in this chapter where the Buddha undertakes one of those discourses that are common in the Mahayana Sutras, where he talks about the sands of the river Ganges, and he talks about making them into powder and how countless particles of powder and so forth, how they become immeasurable, countless, inconceivable, beyond all limit, incalculable, and how the lifespan of the Tathagata is in fact incalculable, immeasurable. It cannot be measured in even thousands and thousands of aeons. It is immeasurable. It is virtually eternal. And in the light of this declaration, this disclosure that the lifespan of the Tathagata is actually eternal, that the Tathagata never really entered extinction, we have, in this context, as an expedient means, we have inserted the story, the historical events of the life and passing away of the Buddha Shakyamuni. So the parable recounts the events of the life of the Buddha Shakyamuni, his birth, his renunciation, the years of striving, the attainment of enlightenment, the years of teaching, and the passing into parinirvana. And it declares that all of this was simply an expedient means in order to teach living beings, in order to demonstrate to living beings how Buddhahood is attained. Buddhahood was in fact attained by the Buddha Shakyamuni, by the Tathagata, aeons earlier. This is a kind of summarization, a kind of reenactment of the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment. In this chapter, the point is made that the teaching of the Buddha is accommodated to the capacity of living beings, that it is adjusted to the capacity, to the aptitude, to the inclinations of living beings. All living beings have different dispositions as a result of their previous karma, as a result of the impressions and karma that they've accumulated over countless lifetimes. They have different dispositions. And so the teachings, the texts, all of these are adjusted. They're all tailor-made, so to speak. They're all custom-designed for the particular disciple. The Buddha did not use, the Tathagata did not use a one-size-fits-all approach to the teaching. The teachings, the texts, they differ according to the ability of the disciple to understand, according to the level of the disciple, the capacity of the disciple. But the purpose of all of the teachings, without exception, is liberation. Liberation is the purpose of all the teachings, no matter how they differ, whether they're teachings with regard to the Arhat path, whether they're teachings with regard to the Bodhisattva path, whether the Buddha is retelling his own story or retelling the story of other Buddhas, other Bodhisattvas. All of these texts, all of these teachings are for one purpose, for the purpose of enlightenment, for the purpose of liberation, for the purpose of crossing over. So again, we can call to mind the example of the raft, the Dharma as similar to a raft, for crossing over, not for holding on to. So whatever the Buddha may teach, one should not hold on to it, because it is for the purpose of liberation. Once liberation is attained, once the purpose is served, the teaching can be relinquished, the teaching can be discarded. And the text also makes the point, which I referred to yesterday, about the disadvantages of disclosing the eternal existence of the Buddha, the fact that those of little virtue will then become complacent, because the Buddha is always present. And the text goes on also to make the point that seeing the Buddha depends very much on the capacity of the individuals. And I've made this point a number of times. I hope that by now it is clear. Remember the story of the shared cowshed, the person who did not recognize the Buddha, even though he was face to face with the Buddha. The Buddha, you see him or you don't, according to your own disposition, to your own karma, to the purity of your own faculties. In fact, there was no entry. There was no extinction. The Buddha never entered extinction. The Buddha never entered parinirvana. The Buddha appeared to enter parinirvana, but in fact, the Buddha was always, is always liable to appear. He's always present. He's always teaching the Dharma on the Vulture Peak at Rajagriha in India. And along with this, there's a description in the text of the Buddha Shakyamuni's pure land. We look around us, we can hardly imagine this world as a pure land. But in this text, we have a description of Shakyamuni's pure land, because it is the impurity of our perceptions that turn, or that render this world into an impure land, into a land where there are all kinds of miseries and all kinds of sufferings and all sorts of deficiencies. But in actual fact, the Buddha is always dwelling in his pure land, which is right here. And that's also, incidentally, the case with the pure land of the Sukhavati school, the pure land of the Chinese school. It's made quite clear that the pure land is not somewhere else, that is really in our minds. And similarly, the pure land of the Buddha Shakyamuni is in our minds. So all we need to do is purify our minds sufficiently, and the Buddha will always be present to us. Now, this may seem difficult. It probably is difficult. It is certainly difficult. Many of us have been practicing for many years. We still aren't able to experience the pure land of the Buddha Shakyamuni. We still aren't able to experience that face-to-face encounter with an ever-present Buddha. But that doesn't mean it's not, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. You know, at this point we can even take the help of modern science. We can get some confirmation of some of our Buddhist beliefs and some of the teachings of the Buddhist discourses from contemporary science. Because today, the new physics tell us that there are hundreds, thousands of parallel universes. That there are universes that are similar to ours, universes that are quite different, universes that are totally, totally opposite or diverse from our universes. And these universes all depend just on an alteration in mental perception, a slippage in time-space, a wormhole. There are many descriptions, there are many metaphors, because just as it's difficult to understand how the pure land can be all around us and how the Buddha Shakyamuni can be seated on the Vulture Peak in India preaching the Dharma, that's difficult to understand. It's also difficult to understand how we could be just a hair's breadth away from a parallel universe that is different. That's why the new science, quantum mechanics, quantum physics, it hasn't become popular apart from one or two films like Stargate and a couple of others like that. Apart from that, it hasn't become popular like relativity, like time travel. Time travel has become popular. Quantum physics hasn't become popular because it's too difficult. People can't imagine that really this table doesn't exist. They find that very difficult to understand, so they ignore it. But the fact is, quantum physics tells us that parallel universes, different worlds existing side by side, are not only possible, but that they do in fact exist. And when the Buddhist text, when the Lotus Sutra tells us that really, all the time, the Buddha Shakyamuni is teaching the Dharma on the Vulture Peak in the middle of his pure land, what is that other than a description of a parallel universe? A universe that for the moment we can't see because of the conditions of our own means of observation, our own forms of perception. So this is the message of the parable in the 16th chapter. I'm going to talk a little bit now about the third chapter. I'm not going to talk too much about the parable of the burning house, because I have spoken a little bit about it before. But I want to talk a little bit about the earlier part of the third chapter, which you also have as an excerpt. I don't think Mrs. Santina will be reading that part, but the first part is about Shariputra and about his his attainment of Buddhahood, about Shariputra's attainment of Buddhahood. And this part of the text is also extremely interesting because it shows us the different attitudes of the arhats. Now, in Shariputra's case, for example, he's delighted. He's thrilled. His mind dances with joy when he hears that he's going to become a Buddha. In fact, he says in so many words that I always used to feel, why am I being left out? Why are these bodhisattvas going to become Buddhas and I'm left out? I can't attain to Buddhahood. Why am I being left out? And I always wanted to ask the Tathagata about this. And now the Tathagata tells me that I also will become a Buddha, and so I'm overjoyed. I'm thrilled. I'm happy. I am really a son of the Buddha, really born of the Buddha's mouth. Because remember, the Buddha in the Pali text tells all the members of the assembly, all the members of the Sangha, that you are, because the Brahmins, they say they're born of Brahma's mouth. And the Buddha says to the assembly, to the Sangha, you are born of the Buddha's mouth. You are sons of the Buddha. And Sariputra says, finally, I'm really a son of the Buddha because I'm not going to be just an arhat, but I'm going to become a Buddha. And Sariputra is delighted. Delighted by this, that he's going to attain to the status of a Buddha, that he's going to be free from all residues, that he's going to have the powers and the attributes of a Buddha. And the Buddha goes on to describe, not only does he predicts the Buddhahood of Sariputra, but here also, even though Sariputra reacts very positively and is delighted by this announcement of the Buddha, but even he is subject to doubt. At first he thinks, can this really be true? Maybe this is the work of some devil. But no, it isn't a devil, it is just skillful means that the Buddha first put him on the path toward arhatship, let him attain arhatship, then when he was ready, he declared to him, disclosed to him his final destiny, his fulfilled destiny, to become a Buddha. And then at that point the Buddha describes to him, predicts his Buddhahood, and describes to Shariputra the nature of his pure land, because Shariputra, when he becomes a Buddha, he's going to have a pure land too, just as all the Buddhas have got their pure land. And the Buddha describes the nature of Sariputra's pure land. And then he goes on to talk about how then Shariputra in turn will predict the Buddhahood of another disciple, and how that disciple will go on to become a Buddha and create, dispose, establish his own pure land. So the process repeats itself ad infinitum. The process goes on and on. But at this point, of course, a lot of people are... Sariputra is delighted. Sariputra is happy with what the Buddha discloses to him. But a lot of the monks, a lot of the arhats are confused. They don't know what to make of this. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. Now he teaches another dharma, a superior dharma, a dharma according to which they're all going to become Buddhas. What is this? Maybe it is the work of a devil. What kind of teaching is this? And of course, throughout the Mahayana text, you find references to the fact that the audience becomes confused. The audience becomes upset. Some of the audience can't accept this shift. They can't accept this change. And this is hardly surprising. This is hardly surprising. Someone who has trained all their lives according to one dispensation, according to one teaching, suddenly he's told, this isn't the final dispensation. This isn't the highest teaching. It's difficult to accept. sometimes you find monks walking away. I told you the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the monks at the end of the sutta, they walk away grumbling among themselves. What has the Buddha taught? What does this all mean? You know? Usually the Buddha's audience praise the teaching of the Buddha, are enchanted by the teaching of the Buddha, delight in the teaching of the Buddha. Sometimes when the Buddha teaches particularly difficult things, the audience is puzzled, it's confused. And so the Buddha then tells the story of the burning house. He tells the parable of the rich man, the old house with only one door, and so forth. And he describes the working of skillful means, the working of expedient means. And he discusses the various vehicles, the three vehicles, the vehicle of the Shravakas, or the Arhat vehicle, the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the vehicle of the Bodhisattvas. And he describes for whom these vehicles were designed, or for whom these vehicles were intended. And he says that the three vehicles were intended for three types of practitioners, three types of people. Those who want to escape quickly from the world, those who want to enter into nirvana, attain nirvana, for those people, the Buddha taught the Shravakayana, the vehicle of the Arhat. For those people who want to achieve solitary understanding of causes and conditions, for those people, the Buddha taught the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddhas. Or for those living beings who want to achieve comprehensive wisdom, who want to benefit all living beings, who want to save all living beings from the suffering of samsara, for those people, the Buddha taught the Bodhisattva-yana, the way of the Bodhisattva, and he taught the goal of the Buddha, the goal of Buddhahood. And so the teaching of the three vehicles is another exercise in expedient means, because not everyone is ready to undertake the path to attaining Buddhahood. Not everyone feels competent, ready, or inclined to undertake the path. Remember the parable of the lost son. The lost son was not ready to take over, to receive his inheritance. He was too sunk in his misery, in his ignorance, in his loss of identity. He had forgotten. He was ignorant of the fact that he was actually the son of this wealthy landowner. And so it was too great a step for him to accept that he was the heir to this great fortune. He had to be brought along by stages, first as a workman, then as a foreman, etc. And then eventually he was able to receive his inheritance, he was able to understand his own worth. And in the same way, it's not possible, it's not necessary, it's not likely that everyone will have the same mental capacities. And it is also part and parcel of the working of skill and means that certain living beings should, in fact, follow the way of the Arhat, should follow the Theravada teachings. As a matter of fact, there is a mistaken notion about that if you practice the Mahayana or if you follow the Mahayana tradition, you can do away with the Theravada teachings. This is true in Mahayana communities, very unfortunately, and this is also very, very true, very characteristic of Vajrayana communities. Again, very unfortunately, a lot of people think, and I meet people like this all the time, because I quite often teach in Vajrayana centers, a lot of people there think it's just good enough to receive initiations and to practice Vajrayana sadhanas. And they're not worried about the fundamentals. They're not worried about the basics. But the actual fact, the way things were done in Tibet, and unfortunately now we're living in a world where everything is mixed up, you know? I mean, everything is topsy-turvy in a sense. In some ways there are benefits. We're all in close contact with each other. We can get practically any kind of information on the internet and so forth. But at the on the other hand, we're all in a hurry. As I said yesterday, we all want instant results. We all want the Maggie Me of religion. You know, just add hot water and pronto, you're an arhat or you're a bodhisattva or a mahasiddha, whatever it may be. And it doesn't work that way. In Tibet, people studied the basic teachings. They studied the Four Noble Truths. They studied the Eightfold Path. They studied giving, morality, good conduct, respect for parents. They studied all of these things for years before they were allowed to study the Mahayana text, before they were allowed to learn about awakening the aspiration to attain Buddhahood. And then they studied the Mahayana for years. They weren't allowed close to Vajrayana teachings until they had 10, 20 years of training in the fundamentals of Buddhism and in the fundamentals of the Mahayana, in the Mahayana teachings. Nowadays people walk into a Vajrayana center, they happen to be there at the right place at the right time. We make excuses, we say they must have the karma, that's why they're there. We hope we're right. And they take an initiation, they start practicing Vajrayana teaching. Unfortunately, a lot of them, before long, they're confused. They don't know what they're doing. Because you can't build a house without a foundation. You need a foundation. And for your practice, you need a firm foundation. So there's no better place to start, really, if you want to follow the path to liberation. Let's not even define it. Let's not call it arhatship. Let's not call it Buddhahood. Let's just say, if we want to achieve something along the spiritual path, we want to become better people with less aversion, less attachment. We want to avoid doing harm. We want to do good. We want to purify our minds. Start to practice. Practice on the basics. Practice on the fundamentals. And you can't go wrong. Then, step by step, you don't have to, you know, this is not something where you have to plan your itinerary right from the beginning, exactly which stops you're going to make along the way, exactly which turns you're going to take. You just start to practice along the Buddhist path sincerely and earnestly, and you will make progress. And as you make progress, then you will be in a better position to make decisions about which particular form of practice is best for you. Okay, so I think we can stop at this point. No?